It is so fascinating to me when the world of the Bible and the modern world intersect in some way. When that happens, it just seems to make the things that happen in the Bible so real. And earlier this week, there was just such an occasion. On Thursday and Friday, Jews throughout the world celebrated the Jewish holiday of Purim. And this holiday is taken straight out of the book of Esther. If you have your Bible with you, I invite you to take it out and turn to Esther chapter 9. In Esther chapter 9, we'll begin reading in verse 17. And if you'd like to mark your spot in that book of Esther, that's where we're going to spend most of our time this evening. Esther chapter 9, and we'll start reading in verse 17. As has been said, thank you for the presence of all. We've got a good crowd tonight. We've got a number of visitors, and we're grateful that you're here and that we have come together to worship our God. In Esther chapter 9, beginning in verse 17, we see this holiday of Purim, still celebrated today, is instituted by these ancient Jewish people. In verse 17, this was the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th of the month they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day, as well as on the 14th. And on the 15th of the month, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who dwelt in unwalled towns celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar with gladness and feasting as a holiday and for sending presents to one another. And Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews near and far who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted the custom which they had begun, as Mordecai had written to them, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them, and had cast Pur, that is, the lot, to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letter that this wicked plot which Haman had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows he built for Mordecai. So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur, or casting of lots. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, what they had seen concerning this matter, and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves and their descendants, and all who had joined them, that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year, according to the written instructions and according to the prescribed time, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every family, every province, and every city, that those days of Purim should not fail to be observed among the Jews, and that the memory of them should not perish among their descendants. What's cool is, 2,400 years later, they're still celebrating. Celebrating these same days. And the traditions that are mentioned here in these verses of feasting and exchanging presents with one another and giving gifts to the poor are still practiced among other traditions as well that have developed through the centuries. Now, what is Purim like? Well, I've read it described as a little bit of Mardi Gras, a little bit of Easter, and a little bit of Halloween, all mixed and rolled into one. Many people dress up in costumes, just like we do on Halloween, or many do on Halloween. Perhaps because Mordecai was dressed in the king's clothes, or perhaps because Esther hid her Jewish heritage, people dress up as all sorts of different things. I like one tradition, how at the beginning and the end of Purim, they read the account of the book of Esther. They do that in their synagogues. They sometimes do that in family homes. And what they do whenever they come to the name of Haman is they have these little ratchet noisemakers and people make noise and they stomp their feet so that nobody can hear Haman's name read, so that his name is blotted out from the face of the earth. But one interesting tradition is baking of little triangle pastries filled with sweet filling of jam or chocolate. And they're called hamatation. I don't think I said that right. Hamatation. And there's a lot of debate as to what exactly these little sweet cookie kind of pastries symbolize. But there's one explanation as to why this tradition started that I like best. From one side, at first glance, it seems like a plain, flaky pastry. Nothing inside of it. But the sweet filling is always hidden. On the other side, just out of sight. And so it's like a little surprise for you. You take a bite, and there's something there that you didn't expect, something there that you didn't see. And so too with the book of Esther. At first glance, Esther isn't even a very religious book. The name of God isn't even mentioned in all 10 chapters. But as we consider what happens, we see that God was there all along, hidden, just out of sight. If we take a bite out of this book, what we find is God is there. Where is God is an appropriate question for the book of Esther, because it is about trusting the unseen God, having faith and trusting in God even when we can't see Him. You know, the time of Esther is likely around 60 years or so after some of the Jews returned from captivity and started rebuilding Jerusalem and the temple and so forth. And it's between 80 to 100 years from the events with Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel that we studied about this morning. But instead of dealing with the Jews back in Jerusalem with direct revelation and the inspired prophets, you know, those Jews who returned from captivity, they had Ezra and Nehemiah and Haggai and Zechariah to give them the word of the Lord, to be explicit about God's dealings and God's actions and God's will and what God wanted. The book of Esther is different. Instead, it focuses on the Jews who stayed in the world, as it were, who remained in the land of Persia instead of going back to Jerusalem when they were allowed to return from captivity. I think through the years, maybe some have had the misconception that when the Jews returned from captivity, they all returned. But in actuality, it was only a small number, a small remnant that actually returned to Jerusalem, while most Jews stayed where they were in these conquered countries of what was at this time Persia. To be perfectly honest, in some ways, the Jews who stayed in Persia are more like us. We aren't going to Montana or somewhere to just live around Christians and restore some sort of perfect society where the church doesn't have interaction with the world. No. Like them, we're trying to stay distinct in the midst of a culture that pressures us to assimilate in every way. As the saying goes, we are in the world but not of the world. A world that can sometimes turn very hostile toward those who believe in God. And yet at the same time, like us, these people who are still in Persia did that and lived in that world without the clear, miraculous, revealed interjection of God. There was no prophet like Haggai or Zechariah coming to tell them what God was doing at this time. And without God acting in a revealed, explicit way, they were left to have faith and trust. And so too for us, as with them, we have inspired scriptures that were written down that we can read and see what God has done in times past, but we don't have prophets now who are explicitly telling us God's working in the present. And so they had to have faith and trust in their time and in their world, and in so doing, they're a very powerful lesson for us. Where is God? Where is God when I hurt? Where is God when the world is against me? Where is God when I don't know what to do? Where is God when I have lost something precious to me? Where is God when it seems there is no hope? If we are truly His people, a people of faith, God is there working for our ultimate spiritual good, even if we can't see Him. And we must learn to trust the unseen God, and the whole book requires us to look for God behind the scenes. Instead of saying, look, God did this, we ourselves have to look and see where God is working. Just a quick summary. Most of you probably know the story of Esther, but Esther is a beautiful orphan Jew who was raised by her cousin Mordecai. And she becomes queen of Persia to King Ahasuerus and ultimately saves the Jewish people from a wicked man named Haman who seeks to destroy all Jews everywhere. Now, that's the quickest summary I've given for any book ever. If you haven't read it, read it. It's an incredible story. If you hadn't read it in a while, maybe read it with your children and maybe they can make noise whenever you get to the name of Haman. There are lots of lessons to be learned from what is obvious and stated in the book of Esther. I love this book. I've preached a lot of sermons from it, but I want to do something different tonight, something different than anything I've ever done before. Instead of looking at what the text explicitly says and points out for us, instead, I want to be kind of like that little triangle-shaped cookie. I want to make 3 points tonight from what the text doesn't explicitly say to us, only what is implied, only what we have to piece together ourselves. And I want to make those 3 points from what is not said, at least not explicitly, because those 3 points really follow the formula of the book of Esther. Trusting the unseen God means trusting at least 3 things that aren't explicitly explained in Esther, but if we start looking, we'll see that they're absolutely there. So let's do that together. Trusting the unseen God, number one, means trusting God's designs. And here's where we get the glimpse, the suggestion, the implication of this in Esther chapter 4. If you want to turn back there with me, Esther chapter 4, beginning in verse 10, but we're looking especially at verses 11 through 14. So Haman has put forth his decree on a certain date. All the Jews are supposed to be wiped out by their enemies. And to incentivize people to do this, they're actually going to get paid like a bounty, like a ransom, if they will wipe out the Jews. And Haman has put this out. And Mordecai, he comes to Esther, who has not revealed that she's a Jew to her husband, the king Ahasuerus, and he says, look, you got to go to the king on behalf of the Jews. And she says, you're asking something that's really difficult. The only way that I go to the king is if I'm called. And if I go and I'm not called and he doesn't hold out his scepter to me, I'm going to die. Like, that's the reality. So notice the response. Verse 10. Then Esther spoke to Hathach, who was the servant of Mordecai, and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law, to put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter. The rule was to be put to death. The exception, the king's feeling gracious, was to hold out his scepter and then they wouldn't die. Yet I myself have not been called to the king these 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. And Mordecai told them the answer to Esther. Do not think that in your heart you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows? Who knows whether you have come to this kingdom for such a time as this? You know, Mordecai is pretty sure of himself there, isn't he? He says, deliverance will arise for the Jews. It's gonna happen. It's just a matter of whether it comes from you or it comes from somebody else. Now here's my question. How could Mordecai be so sure that God was going to deliver? How did he know this? Well, what's behind the scenes, what's not explicitly said is this. The promises of God made it so. Understand that this decree to kill the Jews, this decree meant the preservation of the whole nation is at stake. It's not just those Jews in Persia who have chosen to stay behind, but also those Jews in Israel who have returned to Jerusalem. Nehemiah and Ezra detail to us
how there were many enemies who would have loved nothing more than to have permission from the official authorities to go and wipe out those Jews who were in Jerusalem. And the walls of Jerusalem had not been rebuilt at this point. And so there were very few ways that those Jews would have had to defend themselves. And so what we have here
is the annihilation of the entire nation is at stake. Now, that's significant. Why would that not have happened? Because the line of the Messiah would have been destroyed if it did. And Mordecai knew from the promises of God that there was a Messiah who was coming. And God's people would be spared, at least in part, because God was not going to allow them to be destroyed. He had promised the Messiah would come. And because of God's promise, it was going to happen. But how? How were they going to be spared? Mordecai understood rightly that perhaps God was going to use Esther to save the people. And God today works in a similar way. God will accomplish His designs today. He will accomplish His purposes. The only question is, will we allow Him to use us in order to accomplish those things? God will give men opportunity to hear the gospel, but what He wants, what He desires, is to use you and your influence and your teaching in order to do so. God will see to it that His people have their basic physical needs met. That is a promise that He has given to all Christians. But He wants to use your generosity to see to it that that happens. God will uplift His people with hope. But He wants to use you and your gift of encouragement in order to make that happen. And so a question that I've asked myself a lot lately, how can I be used by God to fulfill His promises, to fulfill His purposes, to fulfill even His providence? We talk about how God is working and how we don't know how, and that's true. But in another sense, we do know how. He works through His people when His people do His will. How can you be used by God in the same way? Not that God needs me or needs you. He can accomplish His purposes. But that He wants me. And He wants you to be used in His service. Isn't that awesome? That perhaps you've come to this place and this time for such a time as this. Yes, we look just behind the curtain. And we see that trusting God's designs is one of the key points of Esther. The second thing that we see in trusting the unseen God means trusting in God's direction. And we know that following God's instruction shows respect for His understanding, His omniscience, His providential care. It shows respect that God knows better than we what it is we need in our lives. I believe that He knows what is best, so I'm only going to do what He tells me to do because that is what is best for me. I trust He's going to take care of things in the way that is best if and only if I follow His direction for my life, because God knows what is best and God knows the end from the beginning. God is not confined to time, and so in all things I trust Him and I trust His word. Now, we know all of those things, but I think an example from Esther really brings this message home. We think about Haman, and we think about Mordecai, and we think about their heritage. You know, a lot of times when we read through the Bible, we hear, you know, this person was the son of this person who was from this tribe, and our eyes just kind of glaze over, and we say, okay, that's great, that meant something to them, but it doesn't mean anything to us. You want to see something cool? Turn with me to Esther chapter 2. Esther chapter 2. It may be nerdy cool, but it's still cool. All right. So here we've got the family of Esther and Mordecai. What family were they from? Let's read. Verse 5.
In Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish,
a Benjaminite. So we find that Mordecai was a Benjaminite. That was the tribe he was from. And the text goes out of its way to tell us that he's the son of Jair. Can you think of any other Jairs in the Bible? Well, there was a judge named Jair. And it also says that he was the grandson of a guy named Kish. Can you think of any other Kishes in the Bible who were Benjaminites? Saul's father was Kish. And Saul, of course, was from the tribe of Benjamin. And so we see, all right, Mordecai is associated with Benjamin. He's associated with Saul, and he has this connection to the time of the judges as well. And don't misunderstand me. These aren't the same people, but they are the same names, and it's likely that he's from the same family. It's likely that Mordecai was a descendant of Saul in one way or another. And so then we look at Haman. What do we know about Haman's family? Turn to chapter 3 and verse 1. Esther chapter 3 and verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. It says that Haman was an Agagite. He's referred in that way. Now, why does that matter? Is there an Agag in the Bible that you can think of? Absolutely. Agag was the king of the Amalekites whom King Saul, the son of Kish, spared in 1 Samuel 15. Turn back there. Turn to 1 Samuel 15, if you would, please. I'm getting bossy. Please turn to 1 Samuel 15. And let's read just a few verses. This is an account that's probably familiar to you, but 1 Samuel 15, beginning in verse 1. Samuel also said to Saul the son of Kish, the king, who was a Benjaminite, "The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore heed the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel. How he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." And so Saul goes and he does some of what the Lord says, but not all of it. And we drop down to verse 8. He also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and so on and so forth. So then we drop down to verse 20. And Samuel comes and he says, "Look, you've not done what the Lord said for you to do. You haven't obeyed the voice of the Lord." And Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. And I've utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best things that should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal." What's implied in that is that they really didn't do all that God told them to do. Agag was spared. Ultimately, Samuel's going to kill him. But likely what happens is there were others who escaped as well that they didn't kill with the sword. God had already told the people of Israel to destroy the Amalekites long before the days of Saul. If we go all the way back, even before the days of the judges, like Jair, to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Here, as Moses is giving his final speech before they go into the land, the promised land of Canaan, notice what he says in verses 17 through 19. "Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt. How he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear, when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord your God has given you rest from your enemies all around, in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget." All the way back to where they were entering the land of Canaan, they were told, "You got to kill these people who are against you and who are against God." They failed in the conquest of Canaan. They failed in the time of the judges. And Saul specifically failed. Saul, the son of Kish. Saul didn't fully destroy this sinful people as God instructed. So what happened? They continued to be a thorn in the side of God's people from then on. We later see David fighting with the Amalekites and continued wars into the time of Hezekiah many hundreds of years later. And the lesson is, you disobey the command of God, and who knows what future headaches it will bring. If Saul had taken care of business to begin with, or if those who went through the conquest of Canaan had taken care of business, or if the judges had taken care of business, perhaps the actions of Mordecai and Esther would never have even been needed, because Haman never would have even come along. But no, they, like us, think sometimes we know better than God. And so we modify His commands to fit what we want to do. We only partially obey, but then we expect complete and total blessing from partial obedience. But finally the people of God do what they should have done to begin with, what God had commanded them to do to start with, and what He commanded was completely destroy these enemies without taking any plunder. And if you turn to Esther chapter 9, the text is very specific about what the Jews did when those people tried to destroy them. What happened in Esther chapter 9? Well, notice first in verse 10. The 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, they killed, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. They killed all of them, the whole family, and then they didn't lay a hand on the plunder. Drop down to verse 15. And the Jews who were in Shushan gathered together again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men at Shushan, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. The remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives, had rest from their enemies. You hear that? That's exactly what was said in Deuteronomy. And killed 75,000 of their enemies, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. And surprise, they are given what they were originally promised by God. God says, if you'll do this, you'll have rest from these enemies. Rest from these enemies who had persecuted them for 1,000 years. 1,000 years of headaches because they didn't just obey God to begin with. Just follow God's commands to begin with, and it will save us all sorts of headaches and possibly make His providential workings unnecessary. In verse 22, as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them and from mourning to a holiday, the text says. And so, what's the application for us? Go out and kill your enemies. No. The application for us is simple. Will I accept God's direction in my life? Because God knows better than me. And how many headaches could I save for myself and for my family and for my brethren and for my friends if I'll just obey what God said to begin with? Even if I don't agree. Even if I don't fully understand. And if we make specific application, we know how much sorrow could have been saved in the lives of so many if we just followed God's direction on fornication or materialism or on pride. Rest is available, but rest is only available if we trust God's direction and follow it. Well, finally, trusting in the unseen God in the book of Esther means trusting God's deliverance. Turn back to Esther chapter 3. Esther chapter 3. Let's notice beginning in verse 5. Esther chapter 3, beginning in verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. On the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, the lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar.
Then Haman said to the king Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasures." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you." Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, the officials of all the people, to every province according to its script, to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by carriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. So they're giving them almost a year's head start, saying this is when you can destroy them. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. As we said, there were Jews living in Jerusalem again by this time. They are certainly included in this decree, but we're told that there were Jews living in every province. And notice when the decree goes forth. You ever notice this? Verse 12. The king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month. You know when that is on the Jewish calendar? That is the day before the Passover begins. It doesn't say the day before the Passover they sent this out. It doesn't even mention the Passover. But for a Jew, they would have known exactly when that was on the calendar. And so here they are, they're making their preparations, and a courier comes into your little city or your town or your province, and they say, "Hey, kill, annihilate, and plunder all the Jews who are living here, and you can do it on these two dates that are coming up at the end of the year." And here you are about to partake of the Passover with your family. And then during the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, these people are receiving this decree of the Jews' impending destruction. You think about that timing. They are partaking of the Passover, reminding themselves of what? Reminding themselves of being in Egypt and how God delivered them from the hands of these people who wanted to destroy them. And then they're telling their children when they're asked. They're telling them this story, this incredible story of how God has delivered them in times past. And kids talk then just like they talk now. And so the kids ask their parents, "Well, why did God deliver us then if he's just going to allow us to be destroyed now? Is God going to allow this to happen, Mom and Dad?" And then those parents have a choice. Do they say in that moment, "You know, yes. That's why we partake of this Passover, to be reminded that God delivered us then, and if we are faithful, he will deliver us now." They have to ask the question, can God deliver us? And of course, the answer is yes, he does, by Esther. Well, trusting in God's deliverance, trusting in the unseen God to deliver us in ways that we cannot understand, that we can't anticipate, that sometimes we don't even see, is exactly what we're called to do as Christians as well. And so we ask the questions, can God really deliver me from pain and sorrow and worry? Can God deliver me from my enemies who seek to destroy me? Who seek to destroy my life? Maybe they don't seek to kill me, but they seek to destroy my life in some way. Can God deliver me from sin and death and Satan and the guilt that comes with it?
we partake of a Passover every week to remind us, yes, by the blood of Jesus and by the grace of God, yes. And why is the pattern to partake of that supper, that Passover every week? Because we, like the Jews, need to be reminded. As we are stuck in our Persia, as we are stuck in this world with so many enemies of the cross who seek to destroy us, God can and God will deliver. He has delivered in times past. He will deliver in time present. And if the world continues, He will deliver in times to come. Because the same unseen God who delivered the Jews in Esther is the God we serve. Only we have a greater and deeper and more perfect relationship with Him through His Son, Jesus Christ. And if you're not yet a Christian this morning, what should the book of Esther tell you? Well, that there's an unseen God out there, a God who has chosen to reveal Himself. And He has chosen in our time not to reveal Himself through a prophet who comes and speaks the words of God. He's chosen not to reveal Himself with some miraculous act. But like in those days, He's chosen to reveal Himself through the Scriptures, through His Word. And we can see and know this unseen God if we're willing to hear and believe and respond. And our hope for you is that you would come to know Him as we know Him. That you will know this God and trust His designs, trust His direction, and trust His deliverance, for it is sure until we're all in heaven together. And if we can help you in that way, even tonight, won't you come now, while together we stand and while we sing.